Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, Natalie Bennett sits in the House of Lords, the upper house of the UK Parliament. She was leader of the Green Party between 2012 and 2016 and is one of only two Green Party peers in the Lords. It's probably fair to say the House of Lords is a far cry from where it all began for her. Natalie was born in suburban Sydney to teenage parents and was the first in her family to go to university. After gaining a degree in agricultural science, she went on to have a successful career in journalism before moving into politics in 2006 and leading the Greens during the 2015 general election. In this episode of the podcast, we'll learn more about Natalie's rise to the top of British politics, how a family tragedy had an indelible impact on her, and why she's so driven to affect change in the world, and what she thinks needs to change in the food industry to ensure a more sustainable future. So I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast Baroness Bennett. How are you, Baroness?
Very good, thank you. And please make it Natalie, Stefan, definitely. You know, Baroness Bennett at Manor Castle is only for very formal occasions, and this is not one of those.
Well, but let's start with a question about that, because you've been quite vocal about the fact that you would like to see the unelected House of Lords abolished and replaced with an elected upper house. Now, the strangest thing I've seen over the last few years is how the Lords has paradoxically sometimes skewered some pretty horrific-looking legislation working against an elected government. And I've been glad it was there, weirdly. So why did you take the role if you think it shouldn't exist?
Well, you mentioned the 2015 general election when the Green Party got more votes than we've got in every previous general election added together. And if we actually had a democracy, there would have been 25 Green MPs elected in that election. Instead, we only got one. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm here in the House of Lords representing all those people who voted Green in 2015 and who are voting Green in vastly increasing numbers in local council and regional elections, not always seeing the return for that because we don't have a democratic electoral system. But I'm here, although as I told the Yorkshire Post when I came in, my aim is to abolish my own job as soon as possible.
And why is that? Just give us a quick rundown.
We in the 21st century, we have an unelected House of Lords. We have 92 hereditary still who are there because of who their father is, and it is all fathers.
Church of England peers.
We have the bishops, and we have everyone else pretty well, except for Jenny and I, who were elected within the Green Party because that's the best we can do, who's here because of patronage. We have medieval systems of hereditary and 18th century systems of patronage, and that's no way to run a 21st century country. But the interesting thing is what you said about the House of Lords doing lots of good things, and that's true. As I speak to you, I'm about to go out and I would say certainly beat the government again and again on the dreadful illegal migration bill. But that reflects the fact that the House of Lords is actually more representative of the country than the Commons is, in that our crossbenchers, our non-party people, have the balance of power. And that comes from the fact that Boris Johnson, you might remember him, you know, about three prime ministers back.
Forgotten that one, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, he got elected in 2019 with 44% of the vote. So most people didn't vote Tory, yet he got 100% of control in the Commons. And, you know, I have a hashtag, no way to run a country. That sums up our system.
Pretty good. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the Green Party. I mean, traditionally, Green Party was I certainly saw it as being pretty radical. But with the growing acceptance of the importance of sustainability, which itself may well be down partly to the Green Party's work, of course, these things have changed. And now, radicalism may be a scary idea for some voters. Is the Green Party, do you still feel that it is still radical? And is that important?
Absolutely. And I think voters are absolutely radical too. Centrist politics is dead, I believe, because centrist politics means leaving things much as they are. And you know, we're going to come on to talk undoubtedly about the food system. Our food system is utterly broken. We have a society, an economy that's trashing the planet on which it's entirely dependent, while also creating a thoroughly miserable society. The levels of mental ill health, the levels of physical ill health, so many people struggling to put food on the table, keep a roof over their head. So people understand that this system is broken, it has to change. And so what we're seeing is politics is splitting the green way, which is understanding there's enough resources on this planet for everyone to have a decent life if we just share them out fairly. Or what we have on the other side is the far right message of fear, or it's a difficult, dangerous world, we've got to grab what we can for us and ours and shove those others away. whoever those others are. Now, I would say that's where our government is currently situated. But people know we have to have change. We cannot continue as we are. And that's good news.
And the problem here is representation, or the form of representation, I guess. The Green Party currently has three representatives in Parliament, two in the Lords and only one in the House of Commons. It's progress, but it's still a low number. Elsewhere in Europe, Green politicians seem to do a lot better. Why is that? What's your party doing to improve its representation? And I guess the word representation is key to this.
Very much so. And of course, most of the rest of Europe has democratic electoral systems where if you get 10% of the votes, you get 10% of the seats. And indeed, the last democratic election, ironically enough, conducted in the UK was the last European Parliament election. And we got 11% of the votes in that. Now, that's a base level of support that's out there for the Green Party with very little media attention. And that's the foundation that we're building on. And we're showing that we can beat first past the post. We now have nearly 750 councillors around the country. We have the first Green majority council on Mid-Suffolk District Council. There's about 30 councils in which we're part of rainbow coalitions, different mixes of local councillors who are getting together across party to build systems that work. What's actually very curiously from the grassroots up, building European-style politics. And what we're looking now, very much focusing on, I'll be working on the weekend, is electing the next generation of Green MPs at the next election. Whenever that comes, we've got some great candidates and some great possibilities. And that's very much, we're focused on getting our council numbers, keeping that graph, which is an almost an exponential level of growth over the last few years, keeping that exponential growth in councillors going, and getting a team of Green MPs down in what we call the other place. So I'm confident that when we take photos after the next general election, Jenny and I will be outnumbered by the MPs.
Excellent. Well, I think it can only be healthy for British politics. Okay, let's talk about you. Let's go back to where it all began for you. Born in Sydney in the 1960s. I mentioned you were the first in your family to go to university. But did you always have a political streak?
Yes. My first politics was feminism. And it started at age five because I was told, because you're a girl, you're not allowed to have a bicycle. And that came from my respectable working class grandmother who thought it wasn't ladylike for a girl to ride a bicycle. And I spent all of my school years going through being told I wanted to do things, and I was told not only could I not do them because I was a girl, that I shouldn't even want to do them because I was a girl. And so feminism was my driving force. And coming from that was a sense of awareness about inequality, unfairness, more broadly than just across the gender divide. And that's one of the foundations of my politics, comes from that five-year-old going, well, why should I not be able to have a bicycle just because I'm a girl?
Yeah. Now, your family was struck by the most awful tragedy in 1989. You, your father and your mother were involved in a car crash and your mother was tragically killed. You've said it had an indelible impact on you. Can you tell us a bit more about it and how it changed you?
Well, I think one of the things that I often say to people who've suffered similar tragedies, the practical reality is that you never, people say, you know, you'll get over it with time, time will heal. Of course, that has an impact throughout your life and you're aware of that. And what you learn to do is learn to manage that. Mum and I were extremely close. People used to say we were like sisters. And I mean, I suffered afterwards what could reasonably have been diagnosed as post-traumatic stress from the experience of it all. But what I always chose to regard it as is if you'd been massively punched in the stomach, suffered a massive physical injury, you would have symptoms and effects afterwards. And I think it made me very, very aware of the risks in the world, but also very aware that we encounter many obstacles, many difficulties every day. And, it does put them to scale, I'm afraid. When something like that happens, you realise lots of other things happen in your life and they're not really that big a deal. And so it's a question of, we need, first of all, I very much believe in Vision Zero. We should be aiming for zero car crash deaths and serious injuries. But I think that's also true of so many other things. I've been through that tragedy and I want to, whether it's workplace safety, whether it's issues of food safety, all those kind of issues, we're not serious enough about thinking about creating a world in which we don't have unnecessary sudden shocks, which like deaths, tragedies like that, which I'm afraid that was.
So let's take this on and talk about implementing change. You studied agricultural science at university. Back then, were you thinking about the food system needing to become more sustainable, or were you just soaked in agriculture and how it worked?
I think what 4 years of agricultural science at the University of Sydney taught me was that the Australian food system, we didn't use the term then, but it just became blatantly obvious that what we were doing was profoundly unsustainable and profoundly disastrous. Australian farming, which imported many of the methods, the crops, the animals from a geographically totally different region. What you have in Australia are extremely thin, fragile, ancient soils, which had no experience of hard-hoofed animals and were utterly unsuited to deep ploughing, utterly unsuited to irrigation. And all of those things had been imported. So I think I wouldn't have been able to clearly enunciate it at the time, but one of the reasons why I didn't continue directly with agricultural science was I could see that this was just an absolutely disastrous model. And agricultural science, as Sid taught at Sydney at the time, more or less told us, yes, we're trashing everything and we're just going to keep trashing it. And that was essentially the foundation. And that horrified me. And I didn't then know there were any alternatives. And certainly we didn't get taught any alternatives in the course. As an example, I'm fascinated, utterly can get terribly geeky about soil science because I was taught soil science as a chemistry subject.
It is also absolutely fascinating. Let's add that.
Earthworms might have got the occasional mention, but no other life in the soil. We had an incredibly detailed subject about clay colloids, about salt, and there was no mention of life in the soil. And now, of course, it's so fascinating how we can have in a healthy soil the ways in which we can stop using pesticides, stop using artificial fertilizers if we just look after the soil.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were learning rather than expressing your displeasure at what you were learning then. But after that came a career in journalism when you could express your displeasure. You could talk about issues. Eventually, you worked for some of the UK's biggest newspapers. What led you to move away from that career and then into politics?
I think I always knew that I would leave journalism after about 20 years. I mean, I worked on the Bangkok Post for a couple of years. And when I was in London on The Times, The Independent, and then finally as editor of The Guardian Weekly, I mostly did international news. And international news can, even in those days, before we got to the age of shocks we're in now, did consist largely a parade of disasters one after the other, famines, wars, coups, etc. And at some point you get to the stage where you either get very depressed or very cynical, seeing yet another one of those things coming through, just like last year's stories. And I always thought at some stage I would stop reporting the news and seek to try and change it. I would have predicted that I would have gone United Nations or NGO kind of route. I did quite a lot of UN work when I was in Bangkok. The politics really only came 1st of January 2006. I may have been a tipsy bit hungover, it would be fair to say, but sitting down and thinking,
Some of the best decisions are made then.
Exactly. I've just stopped working nights. I need to do something about the state of the world. And I thought about, joining War on Want, Greenpeace, those sort of organisations. But really what I thought is the decisions are made in local councils, in Westminster, then in Brussels. What we have to do is stop hoping the wrong people will do the right things and elect the right people.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now, I mean, this is a very much a food industry podcast, so inevitably we bring this to one of the subjects we talk about most, which is sustainability, regenerative agriculture, things like that. They're the things that are really the touch points for our listeners at the moment. So I'm keen to explore the Green Party's 10-point climate plan with a particular focus on food and agriculture. So point 8, I believe, looks at sustainable agriculture with a pledge to give subsidies and training to farmers to help them shift to planet-conscious practices and move away from livestock. Now, obviously, change comes with risk. How would you convince farmers to make that leap and transition from their current agricultural practices?
Well, I think as that point sets out very clearly, there needs to be far more support, far more agricultural extension. Way back when the Agriculture Act was coming through as an agriculture bill, I actually put down an amendment to say, let's recreate a government-backed system. I mean, I think it should be, you know, very much farmer-led, but with significant government resources to enable the support and spread of practices. At the moment, farmers are mostly advised by seed companies, pesticide companies, fertilizer companies, and quite a lot by the supermarkets, none of whom have farmers' interests or nature's interests at heart. And, you know, farmers know what they're doing isn't great, but they have no alternative. I think of visiting over in Shropshire with the Wildlife Trust, visiting a farmer over there, and he was showing me the trials he was doing for underplanting of maize, you know, various legumes to protect the soil and enrich the soil with nitrogen. And, you know, he was going along saying, well, this one's really great, but it costs £12 a kilo for seed. This one's really great, it costs £14 a kilo for seed, et cetera, et cetera. And saying, you know, pointing to the expansive field behind him, saying, I can't afford to do any of that except in these trial plots. And that's because farmers are not paid enough. You know, farmers get about a 6p in the pound out of the food chain system. We need to turn this around, and that needs to be changing the whole system around, stopping the dominance of the supermarkets, relocalizing our system, and making sure farmers get a fair level of income and get the support they need, the advice they need to make this happen. But, you know, we're talking about very big system change here. One of the things, you know, talking about going organic or heading in an organic direction, people say, oh, but how will we feed the world? Well, about 50% of British arable at the moment is going to animal feed, factory farming, or biofuels. What we need to grow is grow about 20 times as much fruit and vegetables as we do now. We need to open up much more space for nature. Factory farming has to end for many reasons. That's a real total change around, and that's really difficult. There's no doubt about that. But one of the first things is to make sure it's not the supermarkets who force farmers not only what they grow, how they grow it, and, you know, the advice comes from the pesticide and the seed and the fertilizer companies.
Yeah. And what I'm interested in about point eight is that it's not a big stick that you're wielding here. You're talking about training and subsidies rather than legislation. And that's really interesting. It's a much cleverer way to come about it, I guess. But at some point, legislation and money has to come into it. How would the subsidies be funded?
Well, I mean, what we've got at the moment is a situation where the government is making a total and utter mess of the whole subsidy system. I mean, I'm, you know, regularly sharing views with the NFU, with the Farm Workers Alliance, with others who are saying there's money here and it's money swirling around, but it's not, no one really knows how to apply for it. We don't know how to get into it. It's not working. So the government money that's already there can be used in far better ways. And, you know, we just have a real problem where the government simply doesn't get it. And I think, you know, what we have to do is also, it's about thinking about what are we trying to produce. We've traditionally thought about producing money and calories. What we actually need to produce is good food and nutrition. And if we start to have a system that looks at that, and this means, you know, big change. You think about the ring of market gardens around towns and cities. Think about what that would do to local prosperity. Now, these were points I was making up in the Levelling Up Bill. If we have a government from the centre with a vision that says, you know, we've had for decades and continuing an idea that farmers get big or get out. What we need is the chance to have, you know, a market garden, small-scale growing, 20 acres on the edge of town. And I visited the Riverside Market Garden in Cardiff many years ago, and that had some funding from the Welsh government to experiment with this sort of agriculture. And you know, one of the things they'd learnt, which any farmers listening to this will be very familiar with, they were there on their own one scheme. They bought a cheap tractor, which was the worst possible decision they could have made, although they didn't have any other option. And, you know, one of the things they learned from that is what you need is, you know, they were imagining five or six similar scale enterprises who could buy one decent tractor and share it between them because, you know, they only need it a limited amount of time, and then you wouldn't spend half your time repairing the tractor. So it's a case of setting up those different kinds of systems, producing, you know, at a rough measure, we need to grow about 20 times as much vegetables and fruit as we do in the UK now to be self-sufficient. And that's for 10 a day, which is what we should be aiming for, not five a day. So we're looking at this utterly transformatory system. And a lot of this stuff is happening. I mean, I'd point to the Kindling Trust in Manchester, just doing great work training people to be small-scale growers and also looking at developing different methods of supplying the universities, the biggest universities in Manchester, with an open book system where the universities are not trying to bargain down the price. They just get told, you know, if you want to buy leaks from us this year, that's what they're going to cost. And they can see from an open book why they cost that much. And the university just says yes or no. It's not a bargaining process. It's not a supermarket saying, oh, well, you know, we're only going to pay you this. Oh, and by the way, if everyone stops buying leaks, you're just going to have to leave them to rot in the fields.
There's a lot of changes to be made, I guess. Now, another aspect of the plan is reducing the UK's meat and dairy consumption by 70%. I mean, that does seem pretty flipping ambitious, to be honest. How might it be possible to bring about a change like that? Do you think it's going to be consumer-led, industry-led, legislation-led, or taxation-led?
Well, I think one of the starting points is legislatively-wise, we essentially have to end factory farming. And if you look at, for example, you over in Herefordshire, the state of our rivers, factory farm, and indeed in much of East Anglia as well, the state of our rivers is absolutely parlous, and factory farming is a very large part of that. The problem with it, we just can't get rid of the nutrients. You know, we have this crazy situation where people are worrying about a fertilizer shortage, and we've got lots of lots of material from factory farming going into the rivers. You know, actually poisoning our fields because there's too much of it. That's a crazy situation. I do a great deal of work. I've got some interns from the British Society for Antimicrobial Chemotherapy on antimicrobial resistance. I think antimicrobial resistance, the need to protect our absolutely vital antibiotics, is going to be the thing that will mean a government has to stop factory farming. Because I can quote the head of the British Poultry Association saying, we cannot farm without antibiotics. And in fact, we're at risk of seeing there's a very grave concern that colistin, which is a vital human antibiotic of last resort, is likely to be used in the pig industry significantly in the next couple of years. And that's a huge concern. These are systems. And if we stop factory farming, which we have to for all of those reasons, plus the fact, of course, I talked about arable growing food for those factory farms, that is food waste. That's most of that is perfectly good food that humans could eat, and it's going to produce a little bit of meat at the end of the chain. So if you end factory farms, then you are in a different kind of situation in terms of meat and dairy production, particularly meat. And so that's the starting point, which is going to have to happen. You know, there's many things that Greens, we say something and people go, oh, it's those radical Greens and their crazy ideas. And then 10 years later, everyone's saying that. And that's true on climate. It's true on air pollution. It's true on a four-day working week as standard with no loss of pay. It's true on universal basic income. We lead and others follow, but we can't. The state of the world now, both the human world and the natural world, we need to get into power and do these things now because we can't wait.
Yeah. And now similarly, the plan talks about encouraging a healthier diet. Now, this is a really difficult one because we've got a terrible track record here in the UK of tackling things like obesity. And God knows lots of people have tried, me included. We're still trying to tackle this one. Nobody's really found great solutions, but it's a changing, you know, there's flux throughout all these problems. Why aren't we succeeding? And what would the Green Party do differently that you think might succeed with?
Well, again, we come back to the dominance of the supermarkets and the dominance of multinational food companies and a government that really simply does not get it. One of my ambitions in life, the Radio 4 Today in Parliament made a really nice program about my early efforts of this about 3 years ago, to get the government to acknowledge that ultra-processed food is a category. And again, this is a case where Greens have been leading this for years and now more and more people are adopting this as an issue. And there's what's known as the NOVA, N-O-V-A classification system, which is very well established, acknowledged by the WHO, accepted by the Welsh government. Many other governments around the world are picking this up and acknowledging that more than half of the calories in our diet come from ultra-processed food. And that's an absolute foundational problem. And the government will not acknowledge even that ultra-processed foods exist as a category. They are going to one day. I'm going to make them.
I'm sure you will.
we have a government that doesn't acknowledge that we need to eat vegetables and fruit and process as much as possible. But we also have to look at this as a systemic problem. This is the green problem. Everything's connected to everything else. You might remember the horse meat scandal from a few years ago. And one of the things that exposed was the fact is that Britons eat on average twice as many ready meals as the rest of Europe. We also have pre-COVID, and it might be changing a bit, but it hasn't changed that much. The double the average commuting time as the rest of Europe does. We have the second longest working hours in Europe, after the Greeks, incidentally. And we also have the highest rate of marriage breakdown and relationship breakdown in Europe. And, you know, when someone staggers off the bus from work, having had a horror 2-hour train journey home with their face stuck in someone else's armpit, and, you know, there's the Tesco Metro or the Sainsbury's local or whatever, you know, you could go home and slow cook a vegetable stew, but you're not going to, and I'm not going to ask you to. We need to create a healthy society. Lots of people, some of our poorest people, don't have any access to real cooking facilities. With the crisis about energy prices, lots of people have not really known whether they could afford to actually cook some food. So we've got to tackle all of those issues together. But at the heart of that is acknowledging that ultra-processed food is an issue.
Absolutely. Well, Baroness Bennett, otherwise known as Natalie Bennett, thank you so much for joining me.